Happy New Year, and welcome to episode 26 of Island CT Podcast.
A podcast about science, nature, technology, and education.
I'm Kelly.
And I'm Patrick, and together we are the hosts of the Island CT Podcast.
Okay, so administration, administrative stuff. We have just completed our first year of podcasts and blogs.
Yay! Happy New Year!
Happy New Year! And we've set up a new website. In general, you can tell we're excited about what we've done and have accomplished. And we are trying to set up a new system for audio this time. So hopefully the audio is something that you will hear.
So before we go too long, we said it was January 1st.
Mm-hmm.
It's Friday, 2016. Mm-hmm. We'll put this out probably on Sunday, the 3rd. And it's podcast 26. Yeah, we already said that.
Mm-hmm.
And we're late.
We're late.
A bit. But, yeah. But I don't think we're going to be late putting it out. I think it was due this Sunday.
Right.
Wasn't it?
Yes. So we're doing pretty well.
Yep.
My blog's late because
blog's late.
I didn't hand it in early enough.
Well, also, I wouldn't have done anything with it.
That's true.
So, yeah. I mean, we were away at Canaan Valley in mm-hmm. West Virginia.
Where we had a fun time.
Do we have any other administrative stuff?
Nope, that's yours? Everything.
Okay, so I have one.
Okay.
We started to use rsync to update our website, which is a huge decrease in load on me,
mm-hmm.
not having to manually upload each file separately. I just run the update. There's one slight problem that I still have to fix. The way our website builder program works is it recreates the whole thing. So every file gets a new timestamp. And the way rsync works is it checks the file sizes and the timestamps. And so it tries to replace every single file on the server. That's not a big deal because instead of having the website builder recreate the website, I'll just have it use rsync for each individual file, you know, so it doesn't re-hit the timestamp. Because most of them, of course, don't change.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't have it handling the really large files like the AUG and the MP3 files for the podcast yet.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's about it.
Okay. So I was thinking we could start with some of our reviews of what we've done this year.
Yeah, yeah. Or do we do our usual blog entries?
Okay.
First?
We can do our blog entries.
That's going to go very fast because
we
covered my last one, mm-hmm. and my next one's due Sunday, and I haven't written it yet. So, okay.
Okay.
Pat's blog entry is blank. So let's move on to Kelly's.
Okay. So over the holidays, we were saying around, Luke just came back from school, and he's starting to build a drone, and he's all excited about that, but he had to take a break for exams. And we got into this discussion about drones, and he was mentioning that now all of them have to be registered with the FAA. And it was this neat discussion about, wow, so how many drones does that really entail? And when we looked at the number of drones that had been registered on the 23rd of December, it was already 45,000. And so it's probably over 45,000 now.
Well, there was that news about problems with firefighters mm-hmm. and drones.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And I saw you mentioned that in your blog entry.
I did.
That started a big discussion for us about...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And it was just one of those events that happened that after our discussion, The day after, there was an accident where a drone crashed down.
Did you see what I was doing?
Oh, no, I didn't.
I just searched for slalom skier drone. So it's Marcel Hirscher.
Yeah.
He's a slalom skier. Yeah, anyway, go ahead.
And the BBC actually filmed the drone crashing behind him as he went down the hill.
It was extraordinary.
It was.
It's a big drone, and it just flew into pieces.
Right. Yeah. It was totally
demolished.
It looked
like it was just dropped straight down. Yeah. Just like a rock out of the sky.
Right. And then there was the discussion about they're supposed to be within 10 meters, but no closer than 10 meters of the athlete.
But you see, that's the thing, right? Yeah. You can make up any rules you want, and if someone decided they're not going to follow it, you're going to have some bad accidents. Well, this one wasn't. I mean, the guy didn't get hurt, but... And if you have enough people, someone will not follow the rules.
Right. And
so it's going to happen.
You know, Luke and I were driving around after that, and we started talking about the accident with the drone and that. And one of the points we made is it's like, you know, you get really used to using this tool. You get confident with it, using maneuvering this drone. And then you become overconfident because nothing's happened. And then you're like, we're good. I've done this many times. I can come this close to get the shot.
Yeah, exactly.
And so it's, you know, how long has this person been running the drone? And that same drone has been running like an ace for the last year.
Exactly.
You know?
Yeah.
So we were just discussing that as just, you know, being comfortable, the user just becomes overconfident about what they can do. So I cover drones, and I have also included in my blog the link for the FAA site to register your drone. And drones have to be, all the drones that are registered are between, I think, half a pound and 55 pounds.
Yeah.
So it's covering quite the variety of drones.
Wait a second. Yeah, that's right. That's what you have. I'm just looking at your blog, 55 pounds.
Yep.
So that's what, 25 kilos?
Yeah.
That's more than a plate on a weightlifting bar.
Which I think the drone that fell from behind the skier was probably at the far end of the weight scale.
Oh, I don't think that thing was up 20 kilos.
You don't think so? I don't. It looked just so heavy.
It looked big.
I didn't, you know. I don't know. I probably, if I looked into the article, I could have found the size.
So, you know, one of my reactions, I mean, I said this, and I think it's been about a couple years that we've been talking on and off about drones and the possibility of building a drone and so on. We have other projects going now, but there's always been this talk about, you know, if they really take off, you know, are we going to have a future where that's being used for deliveries because they can get into anywhere?
Oh, yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And we've always said, if you have, you know, do we really want that? You know, if you have, no matter how safe you make it, if you have the sky filled with drones, some of them will drop out of the sky. And sometimes there'll be people underneath it. You're going to kill them. And we've talked about it, but, you know, you hear about accident, but I've never actually seen it.
Right.
And then here, there was this video. It was just so, yeah, that could have killed the guy. You know, probably it would have just injured him. But if it hit him right on the head, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. We'll be posting the picture, and we'll also post a link to the article so you can see the video footage of it, because it is an incredible shot.
And you know, the interesting thing is drones are intrinsically different from cars because when they stop working, they fall out of the sky.
Right.
Like planes, right?
Yeah.
And when cars stop working, you can't turn them off.
Right.
It's not that you can't turn them off, but you know, they don't necessarily fall on anyone.
Right.
But of course, we've gotten used to cars, and now there's accidents every day on the highway because they stop working, and people make mistakes.
Right.
And they run into each other when cars are going, you know, if it's going above 10 miles an hour, it's going to do a huge amount of damage when it hits something. Mm-hmm. And we've just gotten used to it.
Yeah.
Right? I wonder the national statistics about, you know, how many deaths there are every day due to car crashes.
Right.
And when you think that way, you're like, yeah, you know, drones are going to happen to be used. They're going to be used for all sorts of stuff because we've gotten used to the cars.
So right. And Amazon is actually
you know,
one of the companies that's really in the forefront of
testing
drone deliveries. And
I haven't seen anything about that, but both you and Luke have come across some of their stuff.
The other thing that I thought was interesting with drone use is using it as a method of conservation. And I was thinking of the case of the elephants.
I noticed that in your blog,
And I remember that article caught my eye in Science when I was reading Science that they were using drones to keep elephants away from villages so they didn't have elephants being killed and just conflict between the organisms they're trying to protect and the people who are trying to just get their food and maintain themselves.
Although, if I remember, there was a bit of controversy about possible use of drones in some of these areas because there's always a conflict between the conservation and the people. And, you know, some people really like the idea of moving in that direction, but others don't.
Mm-hmm.
And then you add drones into the mix. And it's like, well, researchers are going to use drones. And then some drones are going to be used to help the local people. And then you got to think, well, that's a great way to check out if there's poaching. And that's a huge problem. But, of course, some of the local people are poachers.
Right.
And so then even if you're not doing surveillance of good people, in quotes, what do they feel like when you got drones going around their villages, kind of staring at everybody? Anyway, those brings up some complicated issues. So I think that's it for the podcasts. I mean, for the blogs.
Of the blogs.
Yeah.
Okay.
Since I don't have mine yet. So, okay. So I'm going to close yours.
Okay.
And moving on. What do you want to do?
Well, I thought we should do an overview of articles and then go into what we read about this week.
Do you have articles other than the breakthroughs of the year for science?
I do. Would you like me to mention those first?
Let's get those out of the way, yeah.
Okay. So there's two things that came up that were, I thought, pretty interesting stuff. It was an article that was in Science. It was not a science-based full review article.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a review about an article, actually, that came from Nature, I think.
Oh.
And so it was looking at the human impact of the ecosystem and when it began. And
I meant to look. Yes. Now I looked at that and I saw it and go ahead.
It interests me because
I totally missed that one.
You know, we're worried about GM crops and what it could do to really shift the balance between the ecosystem and the human impact. And this woman and her group, Kathleen Lyons, a paleoecologist from the Smithsonian National Museum of History in Washington, D.C., and her group of researchers worked on analyzing species distribution.
Right.
And they looked close at the links between species, and they called those pairings aggregations. And what they did is they went through the data, they checked for aggregations in data from 300 million years ago, and they found there were 64 sets that they found where 64% of the species formed aggregations.
Okay.
And compared to 10,000 years ago, where we had 37% of the species.
So it's more fragmented somehow.
Yeah, it's more
with humans.
With humans. And if we look at what humans were doing at that time, that was the first development of cultivated plants. So right. We started into the agricultural base.
Although 10,000 years is very long time ago.
Yeah, it is. But anyway, it was just interesting way of looking at the data. They had 172 data sets.
Uh-huh.
And although this indicates, you know, the trend happened very early of changing the ecosystem with human, or the human impact on the ecosystem occurred very early, it's not, you know, complete.
Do you remember if that 37% was at the 10,000 year time point, or is it since 10,000 years ago?
Well, I'll have to look that up for you.
Because it seems like if it's at 10,000 year, really, it's not. It might be an effect of hunter-gatherers, but there's no...
I'll have to hand it over to you, but I can point out where it
was.
Oh,
okay.
Okay?
Yep.
Sorry, the lighting.
Yeah, we'll have to talk about our lighting experience.
Yeah.
I wrote it down.
Yeah. So, one of the things...
Did
I say it correctly?
Yeah. Well, a big shift occurred roughly 6,000 years ago. That's when I think of agriculture kind of taking off.
Yeah.
7,000, you start to have the rice and stuff. 6,000 years ago. Certainly within the last 10,000 years.
Right.
So, yeah, okay, so maybe it is, well.
So it was just, I thought a very interesting find. More has to be done to understand it better.
Yeah.
But I thought it was definitely interesting stuff.
Do you want to, maybe I could do one of mine?
Okay, you do one of yours.
The reason is that, well, this is going to be really short. Actually, we were reading it in the car together.
Mm-hmm.
It's from the same science. So what issue is this?
This is December
18th. Got it.
18th.
So
okay.
These are articles out of the December 18th issue of Science. There were three articles. One is a perspective and the other two original research,
mm-hmm.
Having to do with change in phytoplankton communities.
Right.
And it's kind of interesting. We only several days ago now since actually
right.
was driving down or up, I guess.
Yeah.
Northward towards Canaan that we're reading this in the car. And the general view, I'm not going to do details, this is going to be super short, but what was interesting about it was that up till now the idea about phytoplankton community mm-hmm. or plankton communities in general is that we're generally static.
Mm-hmm.
And both of these articles, one looked in the Pacific and North Pacific and one in the North Atlantic.
Right.
And they looked at two different time periods. And basically they found that over many years you get these major changes in composition.
Mm-hmm.
And I only want to talk about the North Pacific one, if
mm-hmm.
I remember correctly. See, that's too bad. I don't have anything underlined on here because we're using the paper
right.
version.
I know.
So from memory, what was really cool, if I remember this correctly, they looked at like over 1,000 years.
Right.
And they saw three different, they call them, I can't remember what they call them, but patterns of phytoplankton. And you had one well-established pattern, and then it changed. And then it changed again within the industrial age. And the first change happened during one particularly well documented change in climate.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember what it was. But what was really cool, if I remember correctly, they looked at corals that were long-lived and the composition of their shells.
Mm-hmm.
And they looked at carbon-13
right.
in it, I think. And the idea is...
They're looking at isotopes.
Yeah. And the idea is the plankton's constantly dying, mm-hmm. and then raining down its calcium carbonate shells.
Mm-hmm.
So there's the carbon in there, and that's raining down onto the seafloor,
right?
Where then the corals incorporated into their shells. So just like you look at a tree and its growth rings and can tell the weather yeah. pattern, you can look at the shells of the corals and see what was happening up above them to the phytoplankton
yeah.
by looking at the murals.
I thought that was very interesting.
I thought that was
cool, unexpected.
Yeah.
Very so nice.
Unfortunately, we are not going to talk about the actual findings, but the methods were really cool. So I thought this kind of went along with nature and environmental, so I wanted to cover that now.
Okay.
That's actually all I have except for our breakthroughs section.
Well, I have a short piece that okay. I would like to do next, and it's on carbon tracking.
Uh-huh.
And it links well with the climate talks in Paris. And
is that the one? Does it have a CubeSat part to it?
No.
No.
I said, I wonder if they're using CubeSat.
Yeah?
It was not mentioned
not
here.
Not mentioned. Okay.
Okay. So no, not that. Okay. So they've set up this sensor system, and it's set up by an engineer from NASA. And basically, they're setting up sensors in large areas or large urban settings, large cities, to monitor the carbon output of those cities. And they've done it in Indianapolis, in Boston, in Los Angeles, and Paris. And so they're able to record the amount of carbon that's going out. The other thing that, and they're hoping to extend that to Washington, D.C., but they're hoping that as a worldwide, that these centers or these sensors will be put in every large center so that they'll be able to better understand how much carbon does a city really produce. And when we have talks like the Paris talk on the climate deal, they have actually data to move from.
Right.
And
right.
So, you know, this is one of the pushes, in the United States, and, you know, definitely Paris has jumped on, and maybe we'll see it pop up more through Europe and beyond. Mm-hmm. Interesting, at the end of the article, they talk about how, you know, the point is for us to really think about limiting our carbon, and we have to be careful that we don't see the monitoring of carbon as a way of us somehow controlling our carbon output.
Yeah.
So that the emphasis is on, well, we're monitoring, what else do you expect?
Yeah.
It moves beyond that and thinking about processes and yeah. that we need to reduce.
I understand the argument, I just don't buy it.
Yeah. Anyway, I thought it should be mentioned.
You know, another way to look at it is you do a lot more monitoring, right? Mm-hmm. Of course it's interesting to the scientific community.
Right.
You get more data. You do more monitoring. At the same time, there's more there for people to get interested in it.
Right.
Right? Mm-hmm. So it's like...
there's trends that probably will occur
it could go
in the
either
data
way.
That we have yeah. not expected.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, they could be right. Mm-hmm. People might be like, oh, we're doing, something needs to be done. We're monitoring.
We're doing it.
Therefore,
yeah.
we're doing something.
Right.
So they could be right. It could hurt. But, you know, it could go the other way.
Right.
You can start monitoring and people start to realize, oh, I live here.
Yeah.
Holy crap, you know.
Yeah, exactly.
So, this is what's happening.
Right.
So, anyway.
But so,
the actual monitoring part is cool.
Right. And I wanted to kind of do a little piece about the Paris
talks, yeah.
Yeah, the Paris climate deal. And basically, you know, you have several countries coming on and making a commitment to reduce the carbon.
Uh-huh.
A few things that came up, and I think we mentioned this in the last podcast, is that the developing countries don't have numbers that truly reflect what's happening there.
Mm-hmm.
But honestly, I'm not sure if the developed countries are that much better at, you know, actually putting out all the information they have either. So it's just a thought that I had.
Yeah.
What I like is there's a thought about, you know, really supporting R&D, research and development of technology that's cleaner technology. And each developing country has said that they will fund more R&D and technology for the next 5 years for that particular
area. I like that idea simply because the whole fossil fuel industry has had a lot of money pumped into it. And, you know, for nations have a vested interest in making their themselves fuel independent, let's say. And it's not like if you're pumping a lot of R&D now into solar cell, the argument is not, as an example, oh, you know, you look, we need to put all this money into it to make it viable. It's like, well, a hell of a lot's been pumped in to oil industry also to get it where it is.
And the other thing is the developing countries are asking for help.
Yeah,
they're saying,
of course,
you know,
sure,
look, this is great and everything, but we need support to make this happen. And I like the idea that support would be given for this. Of course, nothing's down formally or how that support will look.
Right.
And
right.
At the end of the talks, 55% of the countries had signed on to the deal. So, you know, it's a start, and at least it's a conversation that's starting. And for some countries, it's gone beyond the conversation, and it's a way of thinking about how we can impact our carbon footprint. Okay, that's it of that one.
Super.
Okay.
Breakthroughs of the year?
Breakthroughs of the year.
So that science issue, the December 18th
one, right,
had the breakthroughs of the year, and it was really cool. So much of what we talked about in the podcast was mentioned in the breakthroughs of the year, and some of it wasn't.
Right.
CRISPR, I think, has just dominated our podcast life.
Yeah.
And it was the breakthrough of the year this year. I mean, there's, you know, this is like a future world that we just have no idea what it's going to bring.
Right, right.
There's so much to be excited about and so much that's just scary about
CRISPR. Oh, yeah.
CRISPR.
And another news article that just hit Science yesterday, December 31st, it's CRISPR helps heal mice with muscular dystrophy. How cool is that? And they used CRISPR-Cas9 system.
Is this a germline change, do you know?
I read it very quickly.
Probably is. I mean, that's where everybody's going with this.
Yeah, I think it is. And although it does not mean, you know, that people with muscular dystrophy will receive help right now, it does.
Well, if it's,
you know,
a germline change, it's not going to be useful for them.
Right. They think that they will be able to find some system to target groups of muscles, micro. So they would be looking for.
Oh, wait a second. It's talking about therapists. Maybe it's not germline.
So some gene therapists are hoping to give people with DMD a micro dystrophin gene that would result in short but
working
versions
of the protein.
Of the Yeah. And reduce the severity of the disease. Yeah. Now, this has not been done yet. It's something that they hope to have.
This actually connects to one of the other breakthroughs of the year. So we can just talk about it off the top of our heads.
Okay.
It's the discovery of the lymphatic system in the brain.
Yeah.
Right? So the idea is that we don't even know where all of it's going. We just suddenly this year realize, wow, there's actually these vessels in the meninges that go through the brain. I think one of the things mentioned was that, you know, once this is all mapped, that could be a way to deliver therapies, drugs.
Right.
And you know, in this case, it could be genetic therapy using CRISPR to different places in the brain. Mm-hmm. By getting it somehow in this lymphatic system. I don't know how you'd do that, but, you know.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Anyway, I just thought, since we're talking about CRISPR, we have a new article that just popped up yesterday. So the way it's been working with the Science News, this was published in Science News by Jocelyn Kaiser, and it will probably be a published paper in the next...
In the next,
issue or the one after that.
Yeah.
So interesting stuff.
So I don't know. Is it worth talking about CRISPR itself?
I thought we just mention it, and
we've talked about it a lot.
We've talked about it a lot, so I wasn't going to say that much.
I have to say, it's astounding how much the potential and how big of a change it is.
Yep.
In just our ability. I mean, it's not new in... You know, there is one thing, I'll just mention one thing about it that is really new.
Mm-hmm.
It's the fact that you just have this piece of DNA that you design separately from your system.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's one reason it's so easy to use CRISPR as opposed to talons or zinc fingers.
Yeah.
Right.
And the cost is much cheaper than other systems. And I have to do a little known fact before we go on.
Okay, go ahead.
Little known fact, which I found just from this article that's in Science about the breakthroughs of the year. It talks about CRISPR actually sprouting from yogurt. And that it was from people working with the bacteria in yogurt that they realized this mechanism. And I'm trying to find where it was. But I thought it was pretty cool that it came from, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. So I have to say something else about it. Let me see. I'm trying to find which one I have open. Okay, there it is. CRISPR. Even though we've had our eye out for what's happening in the CRISPR world, I was surprised in how many things actually are major breakthroughs that I didn't know were happening. I don't think I knew that they actually had. So we talked about the gene drive, right? That's another scary thing that's now easy because of CRISPR. I mean, not just scary, but also really exciting. Mm-hmm. I mean, we could change the world in some ways.
Oh, yeah.
For the better. Makes you think, boy, we better have a bit of humility here because we could
exactly.
But and so one of the things was, since that malaria immune mosquito, they've actually also come up with a gene drive that'll make all the mosquitoes infertile for one species of malaria color. But that's, of all the ones, I'm not going to mention the ones that we haven't come across except for one. It was, let me see if I can find it here. I can't find it. I'm just going to say. But, you know, there's about 20,000 genes in the human genome, right? And these one set of researchers.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you found it.
Yeah.
Okay. So
I knew
where
you were going.
Yeah. Feng Zhang. The Broad Institute in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Right.
Yeah. So they went through all, or about 20,000 genes, one at a time, turning them on with CRISPR. And so this is a different use of CRISPR. Instead of, if I don't remember exact, I mean, I don't know exactly mm-hmm. what, but basically, instead of using CRISPR with Cas9 cutting your DNA and making mm-hmm. changes, what you're doing is you're using, I'm talking about the broad technique here.
Right.
I don't know what they did.
Right.
But I
think
it's, okay. So
I'm listening.
I think it's probably something like this. You take Cas9 that's messed up.
Mm-hmm.
And you attach to it something that will affect the genes. So CRISPR will find the gene, but then, instead of Cas9 having an effect on the gene because it's messed up, that section you've tagged on is now hanging around right by your gene. Mm-hmm. So you could have an activator that matches a promoter right next to the gene and turn on the gene.
So MayApple did that. The MayApple
study. That's how
study,
they did that. Okay.
That's how they did that. So instead of using the technique earlier, and this is where you have to correct me.
Yeah.
It was more of a single gene attack.
Yeah.
But what they found is by grouping the genes together that they were able to get a synergetic response that allowed them to have, it was different than most of the drugs that they had produced to this point where they'd need some kind of chemical to have that effect.
Right.
They could get that effect with both of those chemicals combined.
Gotcha.
With the way they did it. And so when you were talking about it, I was like, oh, that's the MayApple study.
Yeah.
Which
was
really cool.
That was one of your blog entries.
Yeah. And they had to go, they, you know, at 20,000 genes, I'm sure.
Yeah, so,
you know,
so it takes Feng Zhang and
great deal of time.
And I guess it just says Feng Zhang, but I assume he was working with a team led by mm-hmm. Feng Zhang. They went through 20,000 genes, mm-hmm. turning them on one at a time, and I assume it was cell culture, I don't know,
mm-hmm.
To see how resistant the cells were then to a melanoma mm-hmm. drug. I assume they mean by that a drug to treat people with melanoma, you know, with the cancer.
Right.
So, man, 20,000 genes, that's like, holy smokes.
Mm-hmm.
Just check out every single, we don't know what all these genes do, just check every single one of them out.
It is amazing.
So, the power of CRISPR.
Yeah. So, as we said, we weren't going to talk about much. I think 5 minutes has gone by.
Ah! Take it back.
Anyway, I just thought it was funny.
Anyway, one of the other finalists, one of the finalists, the Pluto, they have here the Dawn mission. Okay, the finalist was just several together,
mm-hmm.
Dawn orbiting Ceres and New Horizons.
New Horizons,
Pluto.
Yeah.
And we've talked about both of those, so mm-hmm. that's kind of cool, especially the Pluto one.
Right.
But Ceres is just as cool also. And they didn't mention the failed landing
on the asteroid.
On P-67, was it?
Which actually,
and
I thought,
you know, so much data came out of that failed landing. I mean, that, to me, that was a success.
I agree.
You know,
I totally agree. Now, you start to think about, I guess, you know, it's whatever is bright and shiny for
anyway,
the person.
So we've talked about that.
For persons observing.
Kennewick Man came up,
mm-hmm.
the Native American connection with ancient peoples. I mean, the big thing mm-hmm. there was that, Native Americans, looks like most of them did come across a very long time ago across the Barren Land Bridge and not later. I think it said 15,000 years ago here. Yeah. So, I know, you know, that's interesting. I don't mm-hmm. know as much about that. One of them was the reproducibility in psychology.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's huge. I, you know, to
that one you have to explain more. I did not have a chance to look at
so
this.
So I guess
at all.
It started a few years back where mm-hmm. they started to find that a huge number of publications were not reproducible in psychology. Like a large, not a huge number, a large fraction. I mean, that's terrible, right? And the problem is that you do a study, it doesn't give good, it doesn't give positive results. You didn't find a connection. So you go on to the next study and you don't publish it, right? And a lot of these are just minor effects. And so eventually you find something that has an effect, but it's just statistical chance, right? And then you publish that one. And since then, they've been doing over and over, with this last year, the biggest study, or the biggest attempt at reproducing many studies. I can't remember how many they did, but it was like, 100 studies they tried to reproduce or something. But the point is not that a low fraction is reproducible. The point is that they're actually trying to reproduce them, right?
Right.
And seeing, okay, this is, we understand now better what we know. Okay, so.
It was only 39%.
39%, yeah. So, but I mean, this is really good stuff.
I think so too.
Right, because these are important studies. And so now we know better what we know and how well we know it.
And I totally agree.
We had this in the rest of science. I mean, I look a lot of stuff and it's not as bad, I'm sure, in the physiological and biochemical sciences. But when I read some of the stuff that, you know, from my area, you know, a lot of it I look at, I'm like, geez, I don't know. I wish someone would do this over. And I know a lot of the pressure in our lab is just to keep moving on and get new stuff. And if something doesn't show positive result, it just doesn't get published.
Right, it doesn't get looked at again either.
Yeah.
You know, which may be a loss overall.
So it's definitely a loss. And so one thing that I wanted to mention about this breakthrough is this mechanism that seems just amazingly cool to me. Right. The problem is journals don't want to publish negative results, findings that there was not an effect, right? And it looks like a lot of the journals are saying, yeah, now we will publish attempts at reproducing other results and negative results. So those are two big steps, right? But the really cool mechanism is the publication of the methods in kind of a registry before the experiment. So everything is published about what you're going to do, and then the information comes out, you're required, you know, to give out what the results were, whether they were positive or negative, right? That would give me a lot of confidence in attempting a study and trying to design it better than just trying to get some data that I think is going to come out positive because I need to get a publication out.
I'm wondering if it will actually cause more collaborations to occur too.
Could be, yeah.
You know,
I don't know.
That when I heard you talk about that the first time, I was like, wow, I could see that you would read through, hey, what are people about to do or what are they working on?
Oh, I see.
And then think, okay, so ours is close to that. I should really contact them because ours is an offshoot of theirs.
Yeah.
And maybe we can, you know, bank data.
Right.
You know, and share data together.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that at all.
But maybe that's not an outcome that we will see, but I just thought it would be interesting.
Anyway, I hope this catches on in the rest of science because psychology needs it more than anybody else, but it's not like the rest of us don't need something to deal with this problem of negative results not being publishing and reproductions of results to confirm them or not being, you know, if it's been done before, no one wants to do those studies. Let's see, another one was Homo naledi. So we saw that. I think you mentioned it.
No, I think we did.
But this is more something, I mean, it's a new species, it looks like. Very strange stuff. Long hands for like climbing in trees and stuff. let me see. Do they have an age for like how long ago? Oh, no. That's right. They're not dated yet. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's going to be a lot more to talk about after we know the date.
Right.
Because right now I'm looking at that and I'm like, yeah.
Right.
But I mean, it's weird. So it walked upright. Mm-hmm. It had a small brain, long mm-hmm. hands, so it had to climb trees. Or it right. had a need to climb trees. You know, those are kind of weird traits to put together.
Mm-hmm.
So that's cool.
It just, yeah. Okay. Oh, and one of mine, deep mantle plumes, and rising to the test.
Yeah, yeah, and we talked about it also.
Yeah, and it was one of those that, you know, we were doing geology at the time, yeah. and I was like, oh, mantle
I thought
plumes.
That one was really cool yeah. after you showed it to me.
It is. To think about that, just the design yeah. of how they collected their data, I thought that yeah. was pretty cool too.
Yeah. So I think that was, I mean, the information for geologists is mm-hmm. That plumes that come up and cause chains of volcanoes, for example, like mm-hmm. Hawaii, as the crust moves over the plume,
mm-hmm.
These hot spots, that they extend all the way down to the core. That's
yeah.
really cool.
That's
but,
amazing.
But the whole, you know, how do we know that they did? That they go all the way down, mm-hmm. it's really technology.
Yeah.
It's, the way I remember it is that, we used to look at snapshots of seismic waves.
Right.
And now they look at the entire wave over time and
right.
huge amounts of computing power go into this. Mm-hmm. And it makes the very deepest parts of the Earth, become clear.
Mm-hmm.
While before, as you got deeper, it became harder and harder to tell exactly what was happening, so we mm-hmm. couldn't quite be sure, and so, yeah.
Very interesting.
So that was really cool.
Mm-hmm.
So, let me see, what else?
A vaccine against Ebola?
Oh, yeah, the Ebola vaccine. So that was mm-hmm. really cool. That's another, a lot of these are technique-type things, right?
Mm-hmm.
Because we failed, really, right?
Right.
We had that Ebola epidemic was just horrible.
It was.
And it went on and on, and there was mm-hmm. no vaccine, and yeah, that was bad. The one vaccine that was shown to work, it was like a new system. Is it a ring something or other? I can't remember. I can't find it, but they had a new system to design how they were, who they were going to give the vaccine to.
Right.
And then because the vaccine only came in at the tail end.
Right.
You weren't going to see.
See the overall effect.
Or it'd be very hard to see it.
Right.
And with this system, they could see the effect. So it's like correctly designing your trial for what, you know, what you have to work with, which
yeah.
is an epidemic that's waning.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I would not in any way hope an Ebola epidemic
no.
on someplace in the world, but it's going to happen.
Yeah,
and it'll be really neat to see when it happens how we can tackle this. This
mm-hmm.
might be the time when we can really go in and make a difference for these people.
Mm-hmm.
So that will be cool.
Nice, yeast.
Yeast and opioids. That was one of
opioids.
Yours mm-hmm. too. Yeah.
Yeah. So
that's cool.
This one has received a lot of controversy around it. It's pretty cool stuff that they mm-hmm. were able to bioengineer. There's also a lot of fear that comes with it, that this is something that could be done in someone's basement.
Did they, so it doesn't say CRISPR anywhere here. Did they use CRISPR for this?
I think they did, actually.
They had to, I don't remember. Anyway, the point is they had to add 21 genes.
No, they did. They used CRISPR
did they?
For this. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think it's highlighted in the CRISPR article.
Okay. Anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah, adding 21 new genes. I mean, that's
yeah.
more than just CRISPR, because you have to understand the biochemistry and do all the trials, because
right.
you know, you up one gene and you need it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you need the protein it makes in your biosynthetic chain. But then you find that it changes the amounts of such and such metabolite, and now you have a dysregulated chain
mm-hmm.
somewhere else, and you can't get your yield out. So that's an an amazing feat.
Oh, yeah. And here we're down to lymphatic vessels.
Lymphatic vessels we did already.
Mm-hmm.
And then the quantum was the last one they mentioned.
You'll have to help me with that so one. I did not look at that.
Okay, so it's just the idea from a long time ago that there could be quantum entanglement.
Mm-hmm.
And that's like, you have two particles,
mm-hmm.
and they have a property.
Right.
That's a quantum property. And the one we're all often talk about is the spin of the electron. And that's the mm-hmm. one they actually measured here. And the idea is, the original idea without entanglement is, you know, it's the Schrodinger's cat type thing. This particle or this system exists in a superimposed state. It has both properties that are mutually exclusive at the mm-hmm. same time. That's kind of a weird sentence.
Yeah, it is.
Until you measure it, it actually doesn't have one property or the other. It's got a mixture of both.
How does the measurement change that?
Yeah, the measurement makes it what they call collapse. And after you measure it, it only has the one and it can never go back.
I had to understand that.
This is the type of world that's outside of our experience. And so we can't understand it on an intuitive level.
Right.
Only by studying it as humans.
Right.
And so the entanglement is the idea, well, you can create particles with experimental setups. You can create them in pairs.
Mm-hmm.
And those two pairs, they can travel apart, and they mm-hmm. can both be in a superimposed state. And so in the spin, it'd be up and down spin, two electrons. Both of them are in this superimposed state. If one place way far in the world, you measure one of the electrons, and you find, oh, it's in the up spin, by measuring it, you cause it to suddenly, in quotes, collapse to the up spin.
Got it.
And instantly, the other one will be in the down spin, collapsed.
Got it.
And so that's was thought possibly to be a problem
mm-hmm.
for general relativity, because that'd be information traveling faster than light.
Mm-hmm.
But it actually turns out that because of the way it happens, it's not possible to send information that way. So it's
right.
So it leaves general relativity intact. Don't really understand why that's the case.
Mm-hmm.
And this year, for the first time, they actually performed an experiment where they entangled electrons, measured them something like 13 kilometers apart, caused one to collapse, and the other one was therefore collapsed. And there was no question that it could be caused by some other effect.
Nice.
So I'm hand-waving here. I really don't know anything about this
field. That's okay. I was trying to figure out
but that's the general idea.
Neat.
Before this time, the theory was there. There'd been some experiments, mm-hmm. but there was always a possibility that the effect they looked like in this quantum entanglement and then collapse could actually be caused by something else.
Nice.
And now they know for certain it couldn't have been.
Okay.
So, yeah, that was that one. That's not as much. We don't talk about that type of stuff very much.
No, we don't.
But it's very cool.
Mm-hmm.
It's like Star Trek-y.
So now that we've done a science's overview of the year, now we have to move to our overview of the year.
Yeah.
Maybe not as grand.
Maybe more so.
Maybe more so. Yeah.
Overview of Island CTO.
So I picked a few things out that I thought were a lot of fun.
Okay.
And
do you have a favorite of things we've talked about?
Yeah.
I kind of do.
So one of them was GPS.
Okay. Yeah.
So, and the reason I thought about it is because we use GPS a lot, especially with orienteering, where we're out there and we're, you know, making waypoints
mm-hmm.
left, right, and center. But when we go for a wonderful hike,
oh,
we're also getting
my blog entry.
Yeah.
That's what you're talking about.
Yeah, I chose from the blog entries.
Yeah, yeah.
And so when we're out there, we're also taking waypoints. And it is just fun to come back and see your trail
yeah,
matched up
yeah.
on a map and you're like, oh, that's where we were. Well, yeah. Hold it. Is this map right? Because don't you remember this?
Yeah,
and
yeah,
maybe,
yeah.
Okay, oh, it shifted a little off. But, and oh, we went that far? So, oh, okay, that's where the route went. And oh, you can see how their map matches our GPS, you know, route through here. So, you know, it's just one of those things that, yeah, we have a lot of fun with GPS and having it look at our route and keeping track of it. We have people in our orienteering club, too, that are connecting their GPS with their GoPros so that they can give you a more of a tracking data of where
system.
They're going.
We've and looked at YouTube videos of people that have the combined GoPro image or some kind of video image.
Right.
And then at the same time, on the side, a little inset with a map, and it shows their track actively as they go along. It's a blast when you see someone make a total mistake, totally miss control, go on searching. And
it's fantastic.
I'd love to do that sometime, you know.
So that was one that stood out to me. And also volunteering at Moore's Wall, Moore's Wall.
Mm-hmm.
It was just one of those highlights of the year.
Yeah.
It was just kind of weird and different that we hadn't done.
We'd never done that. And something we'd really wanted to help out in that type of stuff. And we've and I think this is the first year we finally found a time. Okay, the kids haven't been around for a while. We got a weekend. We can do this.
Right. And so if you haven't volunteered to do some trail restoration with a group or for a location that you love to visit, I strongly encourage you to do it. It's a neat way to meet a crosscut of people of different ages and that. I have to say it was more in the swingle side, where so the people are more of the cool 20-ish crowd than our age. But a lot of fun and just a neat way to hang out with others. Did you want me to go on with a few of mine? Or
sure, sure.
Okay. The other one is Pat's progress with the boards. And I just pulled up one where I like the title, The Fantastic Little Success, because he's been working nonstop at these 80-meter
transmitters.
Yeah. And so we had the antenna up where, you know, you can see Pat standing by the antenna, holding it up and running back to the car and trying to collect data about how far a reading he's getting.
I have to say, I had a blast going out with you on the road in our early experiments. And now it's all at home building. But
right. And it was just kind of a fun thing.
Yeah.
But the other thing that I wanted to point out to Pat, especially after doing this, is that he really didn't, you know, he was building, you know, failure, success. And then he went to the art of competition, and that kind of revamped his energy.
The blog entry that's not even up yet.
No, I know.
It drives me crazy. One of our few that we don't have up yet.
But I think it was going to the competition that really fueled the fires to get, you know, to get going and not to continue. Not to get going, to continue the fight.
Yeah.
And then you suddenly got the big success.
It was pretty depressing there for a while.
Oh, it was. And you didn't really know if it was going to be a year to get those park boards going. Yeah. And that's so it was just...
I mean, it's really doing it the way we want is not something that I know anything about. And this really just was new to me.
Well, and yeah. And the other thing is, I just wanted to, I didn't say, oh, failure, but it really was. It was like this ongoing, I try this, it's not working. Oh, I'm going to try this way. Oh, it worked for like 2 seconds and then something else blew. I don't know what went on.
Yeah.
And I'm mentioning it because it was really tough. And it was a point where you were starting to lose just like, I don't know if I can do this at all.
Yep, exactly.
And then when you did get the success, he like pours himself a glass of wine, comes over, and he goes, I can do it. I just can do it. And you just, no, you don't understand, Kelly. It's like, I can do. That's what I'm telling you. Do you get it? And so I wanted to mention all of those. And I didn't pick anyone in particular, but I just thought they all deserve mention. Also, if you're thinking of, you know, getting into a project, blogging about it really helps focus your next step, as well as it helps you reflect better on what you've accomplished so far and why you've accomplished those milestones.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter what you're doing, whether it's a project that you're working on with others, like the Kenan Experience, like the Kenan Fellowship project, it's hard to try things that are new. And it's definitely worthy, and it's definitely important that we do that, because we just expand ourselves in ways. And the whole point of our blog podcast, you know, it's great to have an audience, which we really don't have right now, or at least we don't know that we have.
Yeah, I know. Please email us.
But
tell us you think we're awesome.
It really has.
Or that we're just crap.
Yeah.
We'll be really happy.
We'll be happy either way. But it really has helped us, you know, push ourselves personally in a very positive way of growing intellectually in areas that we had not developed ourselves in.
Yeah.
And I think that's so important. Like the CRISPR stuff, well, the reason I jumped on it is because of all the stuff they were doing in the Kenan Fellowship, in the labs with Dr. Fred Gould, and
because they're doing that.
They're doing that
type of,
and so I had to read it because I'm like, whoa, this might be close to their stuff. I just have to see what's going on.
And oh, do you remember our first? I think it was our first CRISPR mention. In a serious way, like like where we actually talked about articles in the podcast. It was like, oh yeah, this great thing, Dicer. And yeah, there's this other thing, CRISPR. And then the next blog is like, CRISPR again. Huh, we talked about that in the big Dicer thing. Blog after, CRISPR, wow, did you see? Wow, this is like Dicer. The one after that, CRISPR again. And did you see what they did? And yeah, we did some Dicer stuff a while ago.
Do you remember that?
I mean, not that Dicer's not cool, but...
So, they're my highlights.
Yeah.
And
so, I have to say, if you were saying, like, this year was the building year in our blog for me, you've been much more varied, and I've really enjoyed that. Because, you know, I need to stay focused right now until we get these out, and we get meets... which we had one,
right?
Kind of,
right.
But a mini one.
Mm-hmm.
In a more general sense about what we've been doing. Last year you had the makerspace, but this year, in my mind, is the year it really took off. And the reason is that you have all these grants where you've written and you've gotten stuff back, and they haven't. And the year before it was a particular project, and it was getting kids all psyched for this one project. Now, it's like, yeah, you can tackle projects, but it's like kids are coming to do all sorts of different stuff.
Yeah.
And they have the materials to work with. They have Raspberry Pis.
Right.
They have Makey Makeys.
Yeah. And
they have the little blocks things or whatever.
Yep, the little bits.
Little bits.
Yeah. Yep. And I haven't pulled out the Raspberry Pis so much. I'm keeping them back for
But I was there when they were doing a lot with them, right? And there's the camera thing, which total failed, but we worked at it with kids and stuff.
I think I might order one just personally this year to have one to try
and
make sure it works.
Yeah. But the point is that it's become, from last year, a set of individual projects for a particular competition, and then this, and then it's done, and then you move on and you do another one, to just a place where kids come,
right,
and start up their own stuff, Mm-hmm. Some of them get into groups and collaborate on something, but there's always something happening.
Yeah.
And that's more like what a makerspace is.
Yeah. And then I have the group that comes and they're more hanging out, but then that group gets pulled off into the projects.
Right.
And I think that's good. Right. You know, there has to be some comfort with coming to be able to push yourself into new projects that you haven't tried.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I was looking more at the podcasts.
Oh, great. How about you do the podcast? Because I didn't look at those.
Yeah. So, there's the Dicer one. So that's podcast number six, if anyone's interested. The measles one I thought was a big deal. That was podcast 11. Mm-hmm. Not the podcast as a whole, but that whole study about finding me, even though it was kind of statistical and I'm not sure.
Very interesting. About that
part. It's the whole vaccine meals and the horrendous effect it has on the rest of
the immune
a young child's
system.
Life. And
yeah.
that we didn't realize.
No, I had no idea.
but that podcast also is one of my favorite ones for another reason. Opa was on there.
Oh!
And Loki.
Neat.
I mean, that was just all these just wild things.
Yeah.
I don't know if we discussed Opa if that was the main one for him, but I think it was.
Yeah, I think it might have been.
So that's the fish with the full body endothermy, first time ever found.
That was very cool.
And Loki is Loki Archaeota, found in the thermal vents that realigns how mitochondria and bacteria got together to form us.
Yeah, that's really cool.
So, yeah, those were the two ones that I really thought were just really neat. And, you know, before I actually looked on at the... Well, curing the blindness and the polio one were also fantastic. That was 2023.
The blindness one where they're going in and putting in lenses and these kids are getting sight. Yeah, that's...
Those were the ones that I thought were the main ones for our podcast. But before I looked at the list of podcasts that I'd written up, OPA, I don't know, it stuck with me. I just thought that one was really cool, especially... As the fish dives down, the measurements of activity at different times of the day, at different depths, I thought was really cool. Anyway, I think, you know, this might be finishing our podcast.
I agree. Today. I think we've tooted our horn enough.
We are awesome. So, and we're going to keep saying that until you guys...
Believe it.
Email us that we're not. So email us if you want us to... let's see. There was a couple short mentions. Actually, I'm only going to mention one. There was the Falcon 9 Flight 10 flight, which was the first time we got... it was one of those SpaceX flights. First time they landed first stage back on Earth successfully. That's kind of cool.
Nice.
It was in the news. And in terms of activity, so this is, do you have any other news or article?
No, I'm done.
Okay. So me too. Activities and stuff we've done with the website before future plans. Do you have anything?
Nope.
Okay. I wanted to mention two things. First of all, you've had some serious needs for good lighting with their cataracts, which didn't make it a strong... I don't remember that being a major part of your blog, if at all.
No, it wasn't, because it's more of... So I had cataract surgery in the summer.
Yeah.
You have plenty of light in the summer.
Right.
And it's the fall that it started to hit me. Yeah. And returning to school and being inside and... Like, I read inside at home, but we have great lighting because we're readers. And just realizing how much more light or how much more light is dependent on my vision.
Well, so I'm thinking we're going to be expecting some tech reports from you about LED floor lamps.
Yeah. And yeah, actually, I might do a short blog on it just because it's kind of handy to know. And
your Christmas present.
Yeah, it was a Christmas gift from Pat. And I also got the heavy duty headlamp.
Yeah. It was the Petzl.
Petzl.
Yeah.
And
I looked at both the Petzl and the Black Diamond, and I don't know. They were both had advantages, and
right.
I just picked.
So Pat and I like to do night orienteering. So as soon as we get out for some night orienteering,
well, also or camping.
And camping. I knew that I wouldn't have the vision at night that I would need without some kind of light helping.
And for me, you got me some glasses that dentists use.
Yeah.
And I actually used them already to solder a little, the tiny little pieces on. For one of my new boards that came in from Osh Park.
Yeah.
So I'll probably write about those sometime.
Nice. So Pat and I went for our dental cleaning and the dentist came in. And I'm like, so how much are those glasses? Where'd you get your glasses from? And when she found out why I wanted them, she got really excited. And, well, we'll talk more about where you can get them and the different lenses that are available.
So one other thing is you're actually using the computer. We talked about a lot about that it was Windows. I pulled the drive and put an SSD.
Yeah.
We used it. So it's got Debian 8 XFCE on it, and I actually used it in the car.
It's wonderful.
That's how I was reading to you. No, I was reading from paper for the science, but on the way home, I used it all working on our stuff.
Right.
And so that was really cool, and it's recording Audacity. And so, yeah, so the screwed up Windows 1 is sitting between us by our feet and not being used.
That's right.
Yeah. So. That's it. So
I think that's
plans.
Everything. Future plans, continuing mapping and flagging False Lake.
Yep. And more building modules and the main board for Osh Park.
Right. And I hope that Carolina Biological does another STEM competition so that my kids can get into it.
Okay. Well, that is it. So. Let me bring it down to the notes you made for me, Kelly. There we go. Okay, thank you for listening to the Island CT podcast.
Make sure you check out our blog.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.